Democracy is a chorus and it starts with you. Shadow politics.
Let the midnight speak
for the overlooked,
the unheard, the strong and the weak.
Senator Michael D. Brown holding open the door.
Liberty Jones saying
we were silent no more.
From the district streets
to the nation's soul,
every broken out voice
makes the country whole.
Shadow politics.
Turn the dark into sound.
When America listens,
justice comes around.
Good evening and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show that is on a mission to make America think again. I'm your host, Michael D. Brown, United States Senator Emeritus, and along with my amazing co-host, Liberty Jones, we're interviewing the people who are making it happen, not always in front of the camera, but always ahead of the curve. We're not going to tell you how to feel or who to vote for. We're just putting the information out there because it's what goes on in the shadows that really makes the world go around. So come, listen, and learn, because a vote is a terrible thing to waste. And now, more than ever, we need everyone listening, learning, and engaged if we are going to make America sane again. If you got questions, you can call in. 888-627-6008. Our guest tonight is Kamone Freeman. And Kamone is a friend of the show. He's the founder of We Act Radio. He's an activist. And my humble opinion is that every day he's been in the District of Columbia, he's made it a better place to live for all of us. He's out there, doing the labor in the field. So Kamone, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for all you do, and thanks for being here with us tonight.
Always a pleasure, Senator Brown, always.
So tell us about your campaign, Kamone. What's going on? You're running for Congress? I don't see you in the write-in votes, and I don't see you on the ballot. So how's that going? How's that going to work?
Well, I'm in the general election because of the media blackout. Because, the fact is, the corporate leadership of the Democratic Party is has seen better days, if you will, for lack of a better word. And they seem to be more in maintaining the status quo than accepting progressive politics to move us forward and become that true big tent. You remember when they used to say vote blue no matter who? Well, now it's like vote blue no matter who, unless they are Democrat or socialist, unless they are challenging the status quo.
But that's changing, right? You not only have Mondale.
They've been drug kicking and screaming to the left, yes.
Well, and you know what? They just released a poll, it was on CNN, that 34% of the Democratic Party, more than a third, believe in democratic socialism. They support democratic socialism. So,
how can they not? By virtue, it's democracy, democratic socialism. Like, how can you be against it? And at the same time, be more than willing to side with the far right wing reaches of the GOP, because when it comes to certain policies domestically and by virtue of almost everything, foreign policy wise, they are in agreement and lockstep. But to answer your question, I'm in the general election as a D.C. statehood Green Party. And the last time that a D.C. statehood party member defeated the Democratic primary winner in a general election was by Hilda Mason. And Hilda Mason was not only a Democratic socialist, she was a card-carrying member of the Democratic Socialist Party. She was a DSA member. And she contributed heavily to the election of Bernie Sanders. You may remember that name. His initial campaign, that is. And she is the second longest serving council member in Washington, D.C. She served 22 years on the council and also as chairman.
And she was also one of the best, if you don't mind me saying
yes,
it.
There you
she
have
was
it.
Also, so also one to... of the absolute best.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, and thank you for that compliment to her legacy, because she was known as the mother of the world, the grandmother of the world, excuse me.
Yes,
but
she really
Hilda
was.
Mason was the last time we've seen a Democratic primary winner fall to in the general election. So it's been quite some time since then. And I think with our beloved Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton finally stepping down, that changing of the guard, it may be an opportunity for us to see history repeat itself, because she has refused to endorse the Democratic primary winner.
I don't blame her. I didn't endorse him, you know, and I just don't think he's the right guy for the job. So let's talk about, I looked on your website before I let my co-host in here to ask a brilliant question. Let me ask you, about your no tax, a no vote, no tax policy. Now, this is nothing new, but you think that the people that live in the District of Columbia, since they don't have voting rights and they don't have statehood, should not have to pay federal taxes, much like the people of Puerto Rico. Is that right?
Absolutely. And not just Puerto Rico, Guam and all the islands, you know, we are the only U.S. territory that pays federal income taxes at all. And in addition to that, we are taxed at a higher rate per capita than everyone else in the entire country. And I think that it's, you know, far past the time to acknowledge that we need to put an end to taxation without representation. I mean, the hypocrisy of celebrating the 250th anniversary of America and their resistance to taxation without representation is a bitter pill to swallow to continue down that road in the midst of the change of regard and our leadership in the D.C. delegate position, and also with the direction of our country. And I was only allowed into two debates during the primary season, and the two debates I was able to participate in, I made it a point to point out to everyone that I felt that all of the candidates, all nine of them, that was well-funded. $2 million was raised for the Democratic primary contest for this position. And all of them was parroting each other, saying that I'm going to be the one that brings D.C. statehood. I'm like, that claim was both disingenuous and bit disrespectful for them to assume that after Eleanor Holmes Norton and countless others have spent decades trying to get this country to do the right thing, even when we had Barack Obama's first term, the first 2 years of his first term, the Democrats controlled the White House, the House of Representatives, and the Senate, and statehood wasn't even an issue. It didn't even come up for a discussion, let alone a vote. And so, as Malcolm X said, that, you know, we keep putting them first, they keep putting us last, because we're political chumps. And I'm saying, in the absence of statehood, that we should no longer be paying federal income taxes. The goal is to, of course, have representation. But we can't even say DEI in this current fascist regime that's currently in the White House. We have a president who has said that he is seeking a third term and has no intention of leaving the White House. And people are pretending like they didn't hear him. I think it's far past time that we take matters into our own hand and claim the power that we have. And that is something that I'm quoting the late, great Johnny Cochran, who said right here in Washington, D.C., at Union Temple Baptist Church, that the best way to air your grievances against the federal government is withholding the income taxes, and that D.C. had legal precedence to do so.
Well, the only problem with it, before I let Liberty jump in here, the only problem with it is tax resistance is very hard, because most of us don't pay taxes. We get them withheld by our employer, you know, that lovely W-4 form that you got to fill out when you get a job. So it's really up to our employer to pay them. We only file the returns. And, you know, we've done this before. We certainly did during the Vietnam War, and it didn't work very well. And we've done it here in D.C. But I agree with you 100%. We shouldn't have to pay federal income tax if we don't have the same rights everybody else has. Liberty, jump in here.
Hi, thank you so much for coming on today. I'm so delighted to be able to be in the presence of your interview again. You're a great public speaker. And my question to you right now is, if Congress is unwilling to admit DC as a state, then what is the next best solution to ensure democratic representation?
Wow. I'm going to be making an announcement. You have an exclusive here, Senator Brown. I've never announced this publicly on any program. So this is an exclusive for you out of respect for your support at WEAC Radio. For the past 30 years, since my encounter with Johnny Cochran, I have been a tax resister. I have not filed federal income taxes for the past 30 years in support of D.C. statehood and also as a conscientious objector as a war tax resister, because a good portion of our federal income taxes do go directly to fund wars. And unfortunately, we have seen, you know, the military budget explode to over $1 trillion now, and now it includes genocides around the world. And Trump has even come out to say that the federal government has no responsibility to provide services to the American people. They just need to have a strong military. I have to say that because when you make the notion that money is directly taken out of our checks, it makes it seem that we're powerless against the system. Well, Johnny Cochran and others educated me to the fact that you can change your withholdings. It's up to you. You can go to your money. And I have not had federal taxes or state taxes. D.C. is not yet a state, where that's our goal to get to, but that state tax for D.C. hasn't been taken out because I changed my withholding. I failed to file. So to answer your question on how we can make it this a reality in Congress, that a do-nothing Congress that fails to pass anything, I think we can declare to them that this is the challenge that we're making. I think that, for the lack of a better example, if a person walks into a crowded room and yells fire, it causes a panic. It doesn't matter if there's a fire or not. It doesn't matter if they don't see smoke or smell anything. It's enough to cause a panic. I think just by mentioning the threat of tax resistance, because I don't want people being fearful, saying that they have to take matters to their own hands, as I have taken into. But they do need to invest in leadership that's willing to risk themselves to have qualitative change. And I'm clearly one of those people. But just the threat of tax resistance is enough to move this conversation forward. And there's a great organization in D.C. called Free D.C., named after the organization that Marion Barry founded and countless others, particularly, what's our beautiful sister name?
Anise Jenkins.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah.
The original Free D.C. with Breaking the Chains. They support a slow tax, which means that people are making it more difficult to collect it. And they have educated me to the metric of critical mass. Critical mass is defined as 3.5% of the population, which means if only 3.5% of the population in Washington, D.C., which would come out to about 24,000 people, would join us in accepting tax resistance as a liberation tool, as a tool to move us towards statehood, that none of us would have to be at risk of prosecution. And I'm proud to say that in my last election, I received over 22,000 votes. So we're quite close to that critical mass. Hopefully in this election, we'll reach it.
And I think you make it sound possible, too, because I think there are at least 24,000 people in Washington, D.C. that are pissed off about the situation. And it's amazing that they exempt us from having any rights that the state has. But then when it comes to taxes, they treat us like a state. It's my favorite thing about the federal government. But let me also ask you, when I look at your website, I see you talking about addressing the root causes of poverty. Now, Washington, D.C., it's always amazed me that we really are two cities. We've got Upper Northwest. We are the most educated city in the world. More people with graduate degrees in Washington, D.C. than any other city in the world. Yet, when I first took office, half the kids at Anacostia High School did not graduate on time. We also pay the highest taxes, in part because we make the most money. But yet there's still so much poverty in the Anacostia, east of the river, basically. And so we really are a kind of a tale of two cities, to quote Charles Dickens. But what do we need to do to address the root causes of poverty? Because we know I've been broke many times, but I've never been poor. Poor is a whole different condition. It's cyclical. It's and it really is a disease as much as it is anything else. So what do we do to attack the root causes of it?
Well, first,
Poverty.
let me say thank you for taking time to check out my website, and I hope that you and others, on the sound of my voice, will take the time to go to freeman4congress.com. That's freeman4congress.com, and consider making a donation to our campaign, because we did not receive any of the $2 million that was raised during the Democratic primary for the nine people who ran for the office. And the Democratic primary winner himself raised over $500,000, and we can somehow continue to only elect people who are endorsed by their wealthy donors, which is why we don't get any qualitative change for the working class people. I'm part of that working class, and I wouldn't categorize myself to be in the poverty category by world standards, but I'm definitely in the impoverished standards by America. And so many of us is check to check and hand to mouth. And what you saw on my website was talking about addressing the root causes of crime and violence, poverty being one of them. And in terms of poverty, Nelson Mandela said poverty is man-made, just like apartheid, and it can be rectified and eradicated by the will of policies. So if poverty is man-made, then it's been enforced as a tool of social control. And in DC, unfortunately, 30% of our young people live below the poverty line. That's 30% of children in the nation's capital live below the poverty line. Almost 100% of those children are children of color, and that rate is twice the national average. And people need to realize that if you have twice the poverty rate, you should expect twice the amount of problems. So they scratch their head as if one does not connect with the other. You go to a wealthy side of town, there's no problems. Everything's is hunky dory, and everybody's is exchanging handshakes and pleasantries. And then when you go to a poor neighborhood, it's the opposite, because people are struggling. That's just a point, right? You can't make friends with a hungry man, and you have a whole slice, you got a whole pizza, and you're going to eat it in front of them. You're going to expect some problems. But in addition to poverty, we have illiteracy. Illiteracy is higher than the national average as well. And people were, what does literacy have to do with violence? It's been proven that third grade reading scores have been used as metrics to determine prison population projections. And this is coming from the country that has the largest prison population in the world, in a city that has the largest per capita ratio of police and citizens in the country. So clearly, more police, more prisons is not eradicating crime and violence. This is just a profitable way to manage it. And then we need to acknowledge the disparity in the food deserts here. We call it a food apartheid. Ward 3 is our wealthiest ward in Washington, D.C., and they have more. At least twice more, maybe three times as many, excuse me, grocery stores as Ward 7, one of our poorest wards. But Ward 7 has twice the amount of people. So how do you justify that? But they have more liquor stores in Ward 7 than Ward 3. So that's letting you know what their agenda is. And it's been scientifically proven that if an undeveloped mind, I submit to you, that's anybody under 21, I would say 25 for men, because women mature faster. Shout out to the women. But the fact is that anyone that is devoid of key nutrients in an undeveloped mind is more prone to violent behavior. And people again say, "Oh, you're making excuses for violence." No, I'm not. If you give a little kid too much sugar and tell that little kid to sit down and be quiet, what's that little kid gonna do? They're gonna be bouncing off the wall. Now, there's something wrong with the kid or what you're giving to the kid. And that's what we need to start having conversations about, the root causes of crime and violence. We haven't even touched on the fact that lead pipes not only a detriment to cognitive function, it's also a precursor for violent behavior. And we have a government that has given billions of dollars to a billionaire owner of the Washington Commanders to build a new stadium. And that stadium is going to be built, and the first game going to be played by 2030. But yet and still, D.C. Water has projected that they won't have all the lead pipes replaced in the nation's capital until 2037. So you know where the last vestiges of those lead-filled pipes are. And it's giving you an idea of what the priorities is under the current administrations and public officials in the nation's capital. So Martin Luther King said we need a radical revolution of values, and addressing the root causes of crime and violence is one of them.
Well, we certainly do. Liberty?
You know, I really commend you for teaching me all of this, because I think these are so important considerations to have. You know, education, I think, is also a root cause of violence. And I used to work for Amnesty International canvassing against gun violence in DC. That's actually how I met Senator Brown. And it baffles me that every 5 minutes, somebody is shot and it's a kid most of the time. Every neighborhood that I went to, there was some child that had been attacked violently in the last month or so. And I think that's horrible. What are some of your initiatives to help with that? You know, there are the roots, but what could heal them is my question.
Yeah, we have to change, you know, as I said before, Martin Luther King, a radical revolution of values. We have to change our policies and our approach to them. The circle of firing squad of the reactionary policies are outdated. And, you know, from citywide curfews, which is an extension of collective punishment, which is defined as a war crime by the United Nations. But, of course, the United States is defiant of compliance to the international courts, especially when it comes to human rights. But I've been teaching kids chess as my contribution to reinforcing lessons from critical thinking to conflict resolution and working with kids one-on-one. I've taught at least 1,000 kids chess because I felt it was criminal not to have that part of their education. And do you know that it has been a challenge? It has been obstacles. It has been difficult, if I say, dare say impossible, to get the D.C. public school system to allow chess to be taught in their curriculums, even when it was offered to be free. I've only been allowed to teach chess in one public school, and that was in Georgetown as an after-school program. A shout out to Hyde Elementary in Georgetown, the only public school in Washington, D.C. that allowed me to teach chess to young people. But, of course, Georgetown is not the most problem spot in the nation's capital. It's one of the wealthiest areas in the nation's capital, again. And then the rest of the time was charter schools who have more autonomy individually to make those decisions. But it's a systemic problem when you want to talk about education. And then we can go on down the line with the fact that we have food apartheid in the city. There should be regulation over the number of grocery stores per person, per capita, per neighborhood, whatever metric you want to use. And I think I heard someone bring up Zohran Mamdani's name earlier. He was attacked and almost laughed at when he made the notion of having municipal-owned supermarkets. As like, how's that going to work? I'm like, they have commissaries on every military base. Every military family knows about the commissary, and that's a municipally ran grocery store. Why can't we have a municipally ran grocery store here? Why can't we have co-ops where the people who actually live there have ownership in the enterprise, training them not just to be a bag boy, but how to run the enterprise from the ground up into the, from the top to the bottom. Because we don't have a left-right political problem in this country. We have a top-bottom problem in this country. And somehow the top feels that the bottom is best controlled by staying in survival mode. And what we really want to get to is an equilibrium. And people say, well, you want utopia. This thing doesn't exist anywhere. Yeah, well, actually it does. If you take a look at Vienna, Austria, has one of the lowest crime rates in the entire world. Why is that? They have no ghettos. They have no homeless people. They have social housing. Nobody pays more than 30% of their income in housing. So the millionaire can live right next door to the working class guy. But they have the same quality of life. They might drive different cars. They might go on different vacations. But there's a social safety net. And ironically, I need to point out, is that utopia in Vienna, Austria, has been subsidized by U.S. taxpayers because it was partially created by the Marshall Plan when they rebuilt Europe. But it's just that Vienna, Austria did the best job at it. So there are models that we can follow. You hear about our leaders going to China and other places around the world getting ideas, but they're not trying to change the living conditions of the people here. There are people living in the nation's capital and in cities throughout this country and probably throughout poor areas in middle America as well that will get a restaurant shut down overnight if those same conditions existed there. But somehow we have found this acceptable for poor people to live in such a manner.
Well, let me just add, as a guy that lived in Ward 3 for 35 years, I know the problems with 7 and 8 as far as food stores, but in less than a mile from my front door, there were 3 Whole Foods. And in addition to 3 Whole Foods stores, there was also a Giant and a Safeway. So, you know, we had 5 food stores within a mile of my house. Ward 7 is gigantic. And you know, it's just crazy. But since we're talking, we talked briefly about Mondani, let me ask you something. We've all agreed to live, tacitly agreed to live in this democracy. One of the problems I have with Mondani this week is that he's gone off the rails. And I think this really hurts us. What do you think about this? He talked briefly about the notion of arresting Netanyahu, which, of course, he knows he can't do. If anybody has diplomatic immunity, it's this man. And he's not only the head of a nation, he's head of one of the closest American allies. Not a nice man. Don't agree with what he's doing in Gaza. But Mondani's out there talking about things he can't do. And doesn't that make democratic socialists look bad?
I wouldn't say make us look bad. I think that it was a overreach in terms of, as you said, his authority. But I think he's using his position as a bully pulpit. We constantly hear America, that the president is the leader of the free world. Well, the world didn't get to elect the president. So is he overreaching when he's the leader of the free world?
Yeah. When he marches into Venezuela, yes, he's overreaching.
I mean, America is 5% of the world's population, and they consistently are habitual line steppers, in my opinion. And since he is the leader of the largest city in America, I think he's just following the bad examples that was set before him, or bad precedents that has been set before him, rather. So you can't criticize him being a habitual line stepper if you're not going to do the same for his predecessors, especially coming out the White House. But I think he's done more good than harm. And I think that him reminding everyone has educated a lot of people that Bibi has been deemed a war criminal, and that this diplomatic immunity is not just for him. It's for all the other war criminals, like George W. Bush, who could be arrested in another country if they didn't uphold that diplomatic immunity, and this was part of the reason why America doesn't subscribe to the International Criminal Court. But, I think that we need to acknowledge that what's the bigger crime here? Is him overstepping his bounds or him acknowledging the evils of man? And I just want to point out that, Israel is not only the largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid than any country in the world. It's also, what is it, $3.3 billion annually, something like that. They get more funding than sub-Saharan Africa and Latin America combined, and
Well,
not only
especially
for the
now.
and not just for the carnage that erects in a genocide, but also they're provided free health care, they're provided subsidized housing, they're provided subsidized education. They don't have student loan debt in apartheid Israel. They don't have a housing crisis in apartheid Israel. They don't have the biggest what is it cause of bankruptcy being medical debt in Israel. All those things are subsidized by U.S. taxpayers, but none of those things we have here. But we're more concerned about whether or not Bibi is deemed a war criminal and someone is threatening to have him arrested for the crimes that he has been acknowledged by international criminal courts to be guilty of. Those are things that we need to talk about.
Yeah, you're right. And I mean, it's all about the oil, right? And thankfully these guys have they're gonna open the Straits of Hormuz, which I love because they were open before they started all this nonsense. Okay, Liberty. Say something brilliant.
Say
Save
something
me.
brilliant.
Guys, so much pressure. I'm with two geniuses, but how do you think we got to this moral standpoint where it seems that a lot of us are in a survival-based mindset that's, easily conquerable? A lot of us are divided, divide and conquer. How did we get so far into this where we've accepted $3 billion to Israel annually as normal? And how do we step out of that? It feels like we're so far deep into these narratives that have been constructed and threaded into our system that it seems really hard to unravel.
Well, that's by design. That is the intimidation because they just want you to throw your hands up and exacerbation and just and frustration and then just give up. And what good is that? What use is it? And you see that being expressed by the lack of civic engagement. You see it whether it be from jury duty to voting. For example, how many people who are registered to vote? We ain't talking about the people who haven't bothered to register, but the people who are registered to vote don't participate. In D.C., almost over 70% of the people who are registered to vote didn't participate. So that's a marker of that. But I wanted to point out Martin Luther King because my studio's on Martin Luther King Avenue. I espouse all the things that got him killed because I think that is the greatest teacher we have. He's like, where do we go from here? Chaos or community? And so, in answer to your question, I think we must point to his last full Sunday sermon, which was delivered here in Washington, D.C., March 31st, 1968. A lot of people are familiar with his last speech, but not so familiar with his next to his last speech, which was entitled Remaining Awake During a Great Revolution. He says in that speech that far too often people find themselves living in periods of great social change, yet they fail to develop the new ideas, the new mental responses that the new situation demands. They end up sleeping through a revolution. And I submit to you that's the quintessential definition of stay woke, and that's why they have turned that into a pejorative. And then we can, in honor of American 250th, I got to lift up the Declaration of Independence, who, in the very flawed founding fathers of this country, had the vision to include these words. And it says, all experience has shown that mankind is more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object evinces that are designed to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to overthrow such government and ensure guards for their future security. So I think that's where we are, and that's the challenge in our generation. If we're going to pretend that this is not what's really happening, what are we going to do when your president stays in office for a third term? He has conveniently placed U.S. military on democratic so-called control cities in the case that there any resistance. And I'm having trouble trying to understand why people don't see the game that's in play right here. First, they get us to accept in opposition to the U.S. The Posse Comitatus Act, they're supposed to make the prevent the U.S. military from being used as a domestic police force. How is this acceptable? And then we have curfews, we have ICE snatching people off the streets, and they are normalizing all of this, and they're going to get to each and every one of us at some point if we don't begin to resist soon.
Well, then, and why? You know, this is a real problem that I have come on. Where are the Democrats? Where are the Democrats? How did they take a term like woke and turn it into a pejorative? You know, what does it mean to be aware? That's a bad thing for people to be aware, but they managed to do that. You know, they're doing it right now with voter ID. They're out there talking about voter ID, but that's not what they want to do. They want you to prove you're a citizen, which is a lot harder. So they've got people convinced that going to a polling place and showing your driver's license will get you to vote. They won't. You have to prove you're a citizen. So you better be able to find your birth certificate and other documentation, right? Because first, you have to register to vote, and you can't register under the Save America Act unless you can prove that you're an American citizen. That's hard for a lot of people. I went to get my driver's license to get me on the airplane, and because I'm retired and didn't have a W-2 and got my Social Security card when I was 14 years old, I couldn't prove I was a citizen. I had to go to the Social Security Administration and get a new Social Security card to come in and prove it. So, you know, you better have your passport. You better have your birth certificate. It's not about showing your ID like when you go to get a drink or you get on a plane. And, you know, where are the Democrats? Why aren't we out there saying this? I really don't know. How did we let woke be taken by the right and made into a pejorative? It shouldn't be. Everybody should be woke. And that's really what our show is about, right? It's about making America think again, making America woke again. But let me ask you, we're going to have new leadership in DC, it looks like. What do you think of the incoming mayor? Do you think there's more hope if Janice Lewis gets elected than there's been with Muriel? I mean, the district doesn't put much into statehood. Come on, we both know that. They put less than $1 million in it. And we've had people on our show we had Ralph Nader, who said $10 million a year has to be put into it. And we had Mr. Smith from DC Appleseed said the same thing, $10 million a year. And we're hardly putting any money into it. So do you think that Janice will be more stand up for ideas like statehood than our former mayor Muriel has been?
Well, it wouldn't be hard to outdo the job of Muriel Bowser. So that's a low bar. But aside from Janice endorsing Mr. White, I'm in full support of her ascension to the position. I think she is coming in with a mandate, and we're expecting her to be a change maker. We share some of the same mentors. I've known her for years. We've been in the same activist circles, and I'm proud to call her a friend. So I'm expecting a lot of changes around here with her ascension. But what's going to be very telling before she even does anything officially, let me backtrack a little bit, because she's already pissed Donald Trump off and hasn't done anything officially, so I want to give her credit for that. But it's going to be important to see when she takes office and she's called to meet with Trump, how does she respond? Is she going to do like Muriel Bowser, the mayor of Washington, D.C., who flew all the way to Mar-a-Lago in Florida to meet with the President of the United States? rather than go to the White House, which was right down the street? Or is she going to go to the White House to meet him there? If she goes to Florida, then that's going to be a complete capitulation, and we're going to expect more of the same, and I'll be greatly disappointed. If she goes to the White House, then, of course, she's standing her ground, and we can see her, you know, standing toe-to-toe and eye-to-eye. But if she's going to be the change agent, if we're going to see a new sheriff in town, then she may request him to meet her a location that they agree on outside of the White House. So that is in itself is going to determine the direction and the breadth and the depth of her administration. So be on the lookout for that. But
well, let me say that not only did Mayor Bowser scrape Black Lives Matter off the street, but I had a sign in my front yard since my house was the first house you came into in Washington, D.C., we put up a billboard that explained to people if they moved here, they were going to lose their rights. And it was up for 3 or 4 years, and we had people take pictures in front of it and everything. But as soon as Trump came in, they made me take it down. The city cited me like within a few months of him.
What was the citation?
That I was on their property and I wasn't. That my sign was on city property and it wasn't. It was actually in my yard, and I live on a traffic circle. So the one piece that was little piece, because it was big, that wasn't on my yard, was actually on federal property. It was on Park Service property. So the District of Columbia had no jurisdiction at all. The only reason we took down the sign is because my wife and I were going to sell the house a month later. And we were going to take it down anyway to sell the house, but
you know, I took a picture of that sign, Senator Brown. I had a picture of that sign, but unfortunately, I took a picture, and the phone that I had the picture in was seized by the U.S. Attorney's Office, confiscated, and has yet to be returned to me. So I don't have that picture. So I hope you have.
I'm going to send you another one. I'm going to send you another one. Except this time, I'll have Liberty and pose in front of it instead of me. It'll be a better picture.
Great. That sounds great.
Liberty, go ahead.
All right.
So that's a very interesting observation to make about, you know, the different dichotomy of Mariel Bowser and Jeunesse. How would you, you know, pick up the phone and engage in that situation if Trump were to set up a meeting with you?
Oh, wow. You know, that thought has never occurred to me. I have to. So we've had a couple firsts on this show. I made my announcement, and you made the first question that's ever been posed to me. And so I would have to actually put some thought to that. But my gut reaction would be is that unless we was talking about a change of position on statehood, unless it was explicitly expressed that we're here to discuss a new direction for D.C. statehood, I most likely would decline the invitation.
Yeah, I don't blame you for that. I mean, it's just ridiculous that, you know, he's already threatened to take over the city because Jeunesse has announced that she's a Democratic Socialist. And, you know, and the problem with that really is gets back to the root causes you were talking about education and ignorance. You know, I have several degrees in political science, so I understand what socialism is and I understand what democratic socialism is. But the average person out there that's not educated in it thinks that socialism, communism, fascism, they're all the same, and they're not. They're great, as you've already pointed out. It's not only Vienna. There are great socialist countries like the Netherlands and Norway and Sweden. There are many examples out there of democratic socialist countries that are making it just fine. But ignorance is so much of a part. And again, I blame the Democratic Party for this. We should be out there educating people on these things, and we're not. And you know, when I went to one of my first meetings, Kimon, after Trump was elected, this woman stood up and said, as Democrats, we have nothing to be ashamed of or nothing to regret. And I said, are you kidding me?
Wow.
That man's in the White House because of us. If we were doing our damn job, he would have never made it, right?
Absolutely.
But the only people, I mean, we beat him once. Joe Biden beat him the first time, but we weren't doing our job. So he got reelected. How is that? This man has never succeeded at any single business that he's ever been involved in. The only thing he's managed to do is get himself elected to the most powerful political office in the world twice. And we've got to say, how did that happen? Well, it happened because we enabled it. And the Democrats were certainly a part of it. And I agree with you on that.
Part of that progressive arm of the Democratic Party that we need more of. I wish you guys were.
Oh, my God. You know, always since, you know, because let me tell you, I think we all learn from our experience. I know that you have. I know that you bring it. Every time I hear you talk, I hear you related to your life. And for me, you know what? I grew up an orphan from the time I was a teenager. I've been supporting myself pretty much since I was 14 years old, but I was never poor. I always had people that loved me around me and cared for me, but I was never in poverty, but I was close enough to see it. And I saw it over and over again. And I realized when I moved from North New Jersey, from living behind a factory to Montgomery County, that I had made I had changed my life because the white kids in Montgomery County weren't treated like the kids in North New Jersey. When I was in high school, I had a hall monitor who was a sweet old guy that if you made a sad face in front of him, he wouldn't report you to the principal. He'd give you a hall pass. When I went back to North to visit my friends, there were National Guard troops walking through the halls of the high school because of all the unrest that was there during the Vietnam War. And, you know, this is all man-made. It's simple to me, and I don't know why other people don't understand this, but if you believe that God made all people equal, then when they end up at the end of the road and they're no longer equal, you have to look at what intervened between the time they were born and the time they died, right? You have to look at what were the intervening factors that changed these two perfect babies that were essentially the same at birth. What is it? And you know, I mean, is there anybody in America that doesn't understand that brown people make less money, that they're less educated, that they don't have decent health care as much as white people? Is there anybody that doesn't understand these things? And I don't know why we find ourselves in a situation where we are divided so much.
Well, in the nation's capital, the average white family has 81 times the wealth of the average black family. So
that doesn't surprise me.
And so to your point that, you know, when your Democratic party official was saying they had nothing to be ashamed of, that means they are proud with maintaining the status quo. They're proud of denying citizens U.S. health care. They're proud of the wars that's been committed in our name, the carnage that's been wrecked around the world in our name, also with our tax money. So that's what they are saying when they say they have nothing to be ashamed of. And to your audience who's still, victims of those platitudes of socialism and what have you, as it was explained to me, is the best way I can describe it, is that capitalism without socialism is fascism. And socialism without capitalism is communism. And they can just remember that, it explains everything. So we have to have a little bit, and you know, there's plenty of socialist programs in part of this country right now, Social Security being one of them, which is why it's always under attack and under threat. But these are things that we need to talk about. I don't know if your audience is cool. I just wanted to point out that here in Washington, D.C., Bus Boys and Poets, I'm honored to have the support of the owner, Enos Shalal, and he has agreed to host a debate with me and Mr. White. but we're not expecting Mr. White to accept that, because this would be his debate to lose. but he's making the call. So on the outside chance that he accepts, I would love it to have an opportunity to come back and talk to you about that that date. But what I do have confirmed as of today is that we're having a general election to a general strike town hall on August the 12th at Bus Boys and Ports, 14th and V Street here in the nation's capital. Will be live streamed, so your audience will be able to check that out. If you subscribe to WEAC Radio's YouTube channel, that would be Saturday 1 to 3. We're going to have the journalist Sam Hussein on it. People may know of him because he just had a run-in with Chuck Schumer here last week, challenging him at a corruption panel hosted by is it Progress Citizens? I'm trying to think of the name of the organization that hosted that at the National Press Club. That was.
Well, we will post that. If you send me the link, we'll post it on our website too for anybody that's listening that wants to go listen to that. And you know, before, because we're starting to run out of time here, so do me a favor, tell people one more time how they can contribute to your campaign, because I think it's important. Go ahead.
Well, thank you. Well, again, that's Freeman, the number 4, congress.com. They can make their contributions there. And we need all the support that we can get. As I said, the opponents have raised $2 million in their failed primary attempt. And our current primary winner has over $500,000 alone individually in his coffer. So we're not going to we're not going to outspend them. And that's not the goal here. So let me be clear. But your support would make sure that we're able to hit the ground because and spreading this word. So if they can just take the time to do what they can and spread this information and this interview and your platform, well, then we'll be able to go a lot further in having qualitative change, not only here, but around the country. Because what people need to realize is that this is not a D.C. Issue alone. D.C. statehood has the potential of having a ripple effect throughout the country, because it would tip the balance of power and break the tie of the red-blue in the House and in the Senate if we had two more progressive senators, if we had more representation in the House of Congress. So this should be a concern around the country. And then one of my other issues that I'm campaigning on is that no one should spend more than 30% of the income in housing plus utilities. That is a HUD guideline here in the states right now that's used as a metric for funding. Imagine if that was a law that put a cap on housing costs. And somebody, I can't remember who it is, but somebody already stole some of my thunder, Senator Brown, because I also said that we should ban private equity from owning homes, but someone has already submitted a bill, and that's moving forward as we speak. I don't know if it's going to pass, but they're moving forward on it. So shout out to whoever started that ball rolling. But these are things that we are talking about that has the snowball effect of having national implications.
Well, and I never understood why we paid $40 million to get two senators from Georgia elected, Democratic senators from Georgia elected, when if you put $40 million into D.C. statehood, you get two liberal Democratic senators tomorrow, right? Well, I don't know who they would be, but you could bet that they'd be liberal and you could bet that they'd be Democrats. That's why, by the way, just if you're listening out there, Jeanine Pirro, what a joke that is for Washington to have her. But that's why she canceled the stupid suit about the reflecting pool. Anyway, with that, our time is up. And thanks so much for being with us, Kamon. And we'll be back.
Thanks,
and every time we have a guest, we dedicate the song that we play out to them. And tonight, all I could think of was John Lennon's Imagine, because Kamon Freeman is a man who thinks big and always thinks of a better tomorrow. Liberty Jones, thanks for being brilliant as always. Kamon, thanks for being here. And everybody, we'll see you next week. I'm going to Las Vegas, so pray for me. All right. Bye. Bye, everybody. Have a good week.
Come with your questions.
Come with your history.
Come with your hope.
America is calling.
This time, we listen.
Shadow politics.
Make the blue notes rise.
Put the unheard city right before the nation's eyes.
Senator Michael D. Brown.
Liberty Jones by his side.
Turning conversation into a rising tide.
From statehood dreams to the truth we defend. From the stranger let the whole room sing.
Representation
is where freedom begins.
Leave one light on the window tonight.
Leave one chair open.
Leave one question bright.
The shadows aren't empty. They're waiting to be heard.
Sunday night, we give the people